Washington, D.C. every Wednesday from 3 to 4 p.m. for an hour-long Generation Progress Takeover.
Check us out at genprogress.org or on Twitter at genprogress.
And I do my thing like this because it's who I am.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the Millennial Takeover. It is a brand new year, and I am Anisha Singh.
And I'm Charlotte Hancock.
And we are so excited for the programming we have for today, but also the upcoming weeks. You know, we saw last year with the election, young people turned out, right? And now we have the House back. And so we wanted to have this first conversation with someone at Center for American Progress who is very near and dear to us. Ryan Collins, he is the Director of Government Affairs here. And Ryan, we wanted to bring you on because, you know, you've been working with members of Congress and some of these new members elect. So what are you seeing? It's day 19. We're in the shutdown right now. What are you hearing from these members and what is going on?
Well, thanks for having me on the show. I'm happy to be here. It is exciting times here in D.C. With the new Congress. The unfortunate aspect is it is the shutdown, and that is dominating not only the new members' thoughts, it's dominating the news cycle and everything that's really consuming D.C. I don't foresee it letting up anytime soon, and an unfortunate aspect of that is that it is pushing back any of the priorities that the new Democratic House has. It's a little hard to undertake kind of the big legislative leaps when you have 800,000 federal workers who are furloughed or not mm-hmm. being paid and all of that. So all their focus right now is on the shutdown itself. And we can certainly talk about that. I'm also happy to talk about some of the other things that I hope that we'll get to sooner or later.
Yeah, I mean, but do you think there's a hope that there's going to be a deal made where the government is funded, but we also don't have to fund this crazy wall idea?
Yeah, I think it's you're certainly starting to see cracks in the Republican ranks. Not only so last week, the House passed an appropriations bill that would fund the government. All there's seven outstanding appropriations bills. Six of them would be through the end of the year. DHS, where the wall funding would potentially be, was only through the mid of February, and you saw a handful of Republicans vote for that bill in the House. You've heard a handful of Republicans in the Senate also saying that they would like to see some other bills coming, appropriations bills coming to the floor, and then they can have a conversation about the shutdown. I think Lisa Murkowski was the most recent one mm-hmm. yesterday. You've got Cory Gardner, Tom Tillis, Susan Collins. No surprise, all of them mm-hmm. are up in 2020. so there's certainly a political pressure, and I think that Trump and the Republicans recognize that they're on unsustainable ground moving forward. And so I think hopefully, knock on wood, this thing ends soon. And I think it's going to involve them caving.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty crushing. My fiance's cousin is in the Coast Guard and he hasn't been paid before Christmas. And he's got a 1-year-old. It's sort of like, how are they supposed to pay for their Christmas presents? How are they supposed to? I my heart goes out to the people who are really just being impacted by what is essentially a temper tantrum on a daily basis.
I mean, it's not a surprise. It's government. This administration does mm-hmm. not care, right? No matter how many stories you throw at them, no matter how many of the examples, this president is just so out of touch that he just really doesn't care. And the mm-hmm. hope is that some of these Republican senators will start turning. And you mentioned Collins and Murkowski, Gardner, mm-hmm. others. Do you see any hope for other Republicans turning as well?
Yeah, I think you can look at a little further afield. Obviously, some of those are kind of household names in terms of mm-hmm. being the more pragmatic names in the House, or excuse me, the Senate Republican Conference. It wouldn't surprise me if you see Murkowski's colleague from Alaska, Dan Sullivan, also probably starting to talk a little bit more about this. It wouldn't surprise me if you see Shelley Moore Capito mm-hmm. from West Virginia. Mm-hmm. She's actually made some rumblings. She hasn't fully called on an end to this. I can see Steve Daines from Montana, Martha McSally, who was just appointed to the seat for John McCain's old seat in Arizona. Again, all of these folks are up for re-election, and so I think the political consequences, Charlotte, back to what she said before, is that there's families out there that are suffering. I mean, you're starting to see this affect TSA officers mm-hmm. at the airports, and the lines are starting to grow. Yes, the administration has highlighted that, yes, you'll get tax returns, and they found some extra money for SNAP recipients and WIC recipients, but this is causing undue harm across the spectrum.
Absolutely.
And so I think those stories are coming back to haunt these folks.
Time to apply some pressure. Mm-hmm. If any of those states were mentioned and you live in one of those states, give them a call.
Absolutely. So we've talked about the shutdown, but at the same time, this amazing 116th Congress is doing some great things and they're wasting no time. Mm-hmm. We know H.R. 1, the background bills, background checks bill. Mm-hmm. What are the legislative priorities for this year? What are they planning, and what can we be hopeful for?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, you named off a couple already. I think H.R. 1, which I think is a really good way to enter the Congress, which is kind of electoral reform, making sure that there's same-day voting registration, automatic voting registration, a whole host of those initiatives, also anti-corruption and campaign finance related type of provisions. I think that's a great one. We'll hopefully, again, shutdown's causing a lot of kind of backing up in terms of the timeline, but we'll see that on the floor soon enough. They just introduced, as you said, the universal background checks bill, which should be right up after that. We also anticipate minimum wage coming very quickly at that, so $15 an hour across the nation. And more importantly, when you actually look back at the campaigns that were run this past fall, three kind of big buckets kind of come out. The first being healthcare. So mm-hmm. we can certainly talk a little bit more about shoring up the ACA, pushing back on the Trump administration's sabotage of the marketplaces. We can also talk about drug pricing. Maybe this isn't necessarily a millennial issue so far, but it is a huge pressing issue for the vast majority of Americans. Donald Trump has even talked about it and saying that this potentially could be a place that there could be some bipartisan solutions.
I mean, people forget millennials are now in their late 30s. Every issue impacts us, so yeah. It's very relevant.
Ryan, I heard you throw out your back over the holidays.
I was just saying that the age is coming. So drug pricing is going to be a huge issue. I think there's some low-hanging fruit there. There's a bill called the CREATES Act, Pay for Delay, which is an instance where the pharmaceutical companies pay generic companies not to necessarily produce. So I think seeing bans on that would be a good you could certainly guess that to be upfront. More of like a Medicare negotiation package, something that Bernie Sanders has championed for a long time, is becoming far more of a realistic idea. So those are kind of within the healthcare buckets. I think you'll see a lot of that. The other big one is kind of raising wages and boosting infrastructure spending. This is something that no matter who you talk to on the Hill, from the oldest, wisest veteran to the youngest, greenest member, infrastructure spending is something that Democrats have always been for. $1 trillion is kind of the goal I think a lot of folks are aiming to hit. And so that's something that I think, given that there's $2 trillion of outstanding infrastructure investment, when you look at what the engineers have said, the American Engineers Association saying that outstanding just in repairs, not to mention when we talk about climate change and sustainable infrastructure and making sure that we're preparing for the next big natural disaster, there's lots of stuff there. And that's also gets to a larger aspect of just including climate in the conversation in a way that hasn't been done before. Mm-hmm. So we'll see that boosting wages through that. It's a huge investment in stimulus into the U.S. economy. So I could certainly see Democrats pushing a form of that. And then the third kind of big bucket that they all ran on was, again, kind of corruption and cleaning up the mm-hmm. swamp that that Trump has originally ran on and only made worse.
Yeah.
And so I can imagine you seeing a lot of investigative hearings from House Oversight and Government Reform, led mm-hmm. by Elijah Cummings, to even the subcommittees in Energy and Commerce, Ways and Means. This will include Trump's tax returns. This will include, again, kind of the former days of Scott Pruitt and all the ridiculous things the cabinet members have gotten away with for the last 2 years. Also, again, kind of linking back to drug pricing, bringing in the pharmaceutical companies and CEOs and having them justify their ridiculous price increases. I think you will be seeing a lot of this. And the great thing is like for the last decade, we haven't had the House in a meaningful way. And so having this ability to not only take on the administration as well as kind of the corporate powers in the U.S. that have consolidated power, there's a lot of activism there, so we're looking forward to that.
It's gonna be quite a year. Well, we are out of time, but Ryan, where can folks go to learn more about you and to follow you and keep up with some of these updates?
Sure. Yeah, you can always check out the Center for American Progress's website, or you can follow me on Twitter at Collins R. I'm always happy to be posting the most recent congressional updates on the what's going on. So.
Okay, wonderful. Well, when we return, we're going to continue this conversation. I want to keep talking to you about how can we do this with a Senate that is Republican. So when we get back, we'll have more of a conversation with Ryan Collins.
Welcome back to the Millennial Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm your host, Charlotte Hancock, with my co-host,
Anisha Singh.
And here we have Ryan Collins from the Center for American Progress, and he is the director of their government affairs team. And we're talking about what we can look forward to from the 116th Congress. Shutdown aside, border wall aside, presidential tantrums aside, we're talking about where we're going to have some progress as soon as we can get this show on the road. So, Ryan, before the break, we were talking a little bit about the progressive agenda and some of the things like voter rights and H.R. 1, some gun legislation involving background checks and that sort of thing that people are that the Hill's really going to be focused on. How are we going to get people to, excuse like the turn of phrase here talking about guns, but how are we going to get progressives to stick to their guns on the Hill and actually get this stuff to move?
Yeah, so I think when you're looking on the House side, you have a whole new cadre of new members that I think when I'm up there, there's this whole new energy, which is just it's exciting to see. And so I don't think you need a whole lot of motivation for those members as much as you need probably for the ones who've been around for a decade or two. Pressure always works. Calling your offices, I know we've been doing that for 2 years now, but that stuff really does matter to
the longest 2 years ever.
I know. but that stuff really does matter to the members themselves. They're always checking to see specifically how many calls have been coming in, how many letters they've gotten on specific issues, what issues are arising to the day. And so making sure that the pressure on House members stays there, and importantly, like when they do pass important stuff, thanking them for doing so. That goes a long way. It's not a very it's a very thankless job in a lot of instances. And so hearing from your constituents and activists that you're doing the right thing is always a good thing. And then you have to pivot over to the Senate, which is still very much in Republican hands. The good thing that's changed since the last election is that a new third of the Senate is up for re-election, and this time around, Democrats I don't know the specific numbers, but I think are only having to defend like 6 seats compared to the Republicans 20 or something like that. So you have a huge political opportunity, not to mention that Trump's going to be on the ballot coming in 2020, where, as we kind of mentioned with the shutdown, there's these vulnerable, sometimes more pragmatic members that come from states that Hillary Clinton either carried or closely carried, that are going to be feeling a lot of pressure moving forward. And this is particularly true given the kind of when you look at the exit polling and the changes in what makes up the new Democratic coalition. You have educated suburban voters. You have women who are voting disproportionately in favor of Democrats, of almost like on a 30% margin, whereas even back in 2016 we were talking single digits. And so there's just a huge emphasis on making sure that these Republican senators know that not only is their time up, but they need to make sure that they're willing to vote for these types of things. And so McConnell is going to try to put as much of a kibosh on any of the progress coming out of the House, but with pressure, as we saw kind of through the healthcare fight, like that changed a lot of senators' minds. We saw that as well through tax and certain other kind of big fights that we've had. We've certainly seen that with the immigration and DACA fight last year. And so I think it's just constant pressure. And I know we had mentioned this a little earlier during the break, but social media has really kind of taken a whole new dimension in the conversation. I think Alexandria Ocasio Cortez, or AOC, it makes it easier for me to say, has truly revolutionized the way that you're supposed to use social media, and has been putting out this great content. And so I think activists and everybody should take note and use similar tactics, similar content creation, and all these other things to again push these Senate Republicans,
activists and candidates,
and candidates,
yeah,
to do the right thing and vote the right way.
So we actually have someone on the line. Michael from the Bronx, New York, wants to know, you know, the top priority for the 106th in Congress needs to be investigating Trump's bad acts, and he wants to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So the.
Hey, Michael.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Oh, okay. That scared me for a minute.
Go ahead.
What we're seeing here is a crisis, but not the way Trump is manufacturing, because he is the crisis. When you look at what's happened during the past couple of years with Charlottesville, what's going on in his rallies, he incites hate, racism, sexism, and violence. He boasts about it and violating women and minorities. And to me, anybody else that does those things will have already been arrested and prosecuted, because these are criminal acts. And in my view, he is an organized crime boss. I don't think we should have to wait for Russia and the Russia report when you have what I have just laid out. And I would love to see the Democrats, and I applaud them for getting off at a fine start, investigate, take action, hold this guy accountable.
Absolutely.
I find impeachment is inevitable, and not just impeachment, but remove and prosecute the.
Absolutely, Michael. And Ryan, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I think one of the great things of Democrats retaking the House is that they now have subpoena power for their oversight and investigative role, which is very much part of their Article 1 powers coming from the Constitution. This is going to be, I think, probably one of the main levers that they have to really go after this administration. As the caller highlighted, there are so many things that this administration has done that are so below board when it comes to not only ethics, but in terms of actual corruption and bringing industry in conversations that when they're trying to decide their regulatory agenda, having industry pretty much write these things, or the lobbyists themselves writing these things, it's really problematic. And again, I think it's going to be very interesting to watch Elijah Cummings specifically, since he's kind of the top dog when it comes to the oversight agenda, to see what he's able to do.
Absolutely. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for being on the show. We appreciate your time. There's so much to look forward to and so much to watch in the coming year on the Congress. Again, to reach Ryan, you can reach him at CollinsSR on Twitter. Thank you all. We'll be back after the break.
Hey.
Welcome back. We're the Millennial Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. I'm your co-host, Charlotte Hancock, and I'm here with my colleague,
Anisha Singh.
Hello. And right before the break, we were talking about federal priorities for progressives with this new Congress. But we're also really excited to talk about what states can do and where there are big changes and shifts with state power. So on the phone here, we have three different organizers from groups all over the country. We have Alex Burnell, the advocacy manager from Move Texas. We also have Dylan Carney, the state director from New Hampshire, the New Hampshire Youth Movement. And we have Charlie Olena, the advocacy director from New Era, Colorado. And I actually wanted to start out with you, Charlie, ask you a couple questions to begin with. So, Charlie, in Colorado, a coalition of progressives, including young people, immigrants, and women, shifted the balance of power in really big ways. In the November midterm elections, the Democrats retained the governor's mansion, ushered in the first openly gay man as governor of the state, and held the state house and flipped the Senate. So what are some of your thoughts on the newly elected leaders and the opportunities for action in 2019, Charlie?
That is a really great question. And I'll kind of speak from the perspective of young people, since that's, what we
love
do
it. Perfect.
But
that's what we want.
Young people turned out, in mass last November, and that participation has, like you've pointed out, absolutely changed the political landscape. of our state here in Colorado. And one of the things about our election results that I think is particularly exciting is that it was really issues that won the day. So the candidates who called for action on issues that my generation cares about the most, things like economic justice, healthcare, immigration reform, gun violence, equality, you know, those were the candidates that won. And young people's participation has really set forth a mandate for change, especially around economic issues. And we're seeing leaders respond to that. So here in Colorado, at least, you know, we're kind of done talking about young people being powerful in the future. You know, young voters are realizing that power right now. And our leaders are definitely recognizing that. And it's already, you know, resulting in policy change. So, for example, a lot of the kind of very first bills that were introduced this legislative session were looking at student debt reform, a huge issue for young voters. And our number one priority bill as an organization is a borrower's bill of rights that would increase accountability and oversight for student loan servicers, increase resources and support for student loan borrowers in our state, and improve transparency and fairness for, you know, hundreds of thousands of Coloradans paying back student loans. And this year, that bill was introduced as Senate Bill 2, which is, you know, a symbolic gesture that demonstrates it's a priority for our Senate to get done, which is really exciting because, you know, with this new political landscape, we're able to not only advance really common sense policy solutions like that bill, but we're also able to have more serious conversations about more progressive policies like expansive loan forgiveness programs, starting to talk about what debt-free college could look like in this state. And we haven't had those kinds of openings and opportunities in the past.
I'm so excited to hear that you guys are working on college affordability and student debt. The Borrower's Bill of Rights is something that's totally near and dear to my heart. I think I'm real mad at Navient and all those other servicers for abusing their power for as long as they have. So, you know, hats off to y'all, Charlie.
Also, I'll just say, as a Floridian, listening to Charlotte list off all of the great wins you guys had, that gives me so much FOMO because our entire state went so red. So red. Just side note.
My next question, actually, Dylan, I'd love to ask you a little bit more about how things have shifted in New Hampshire. So, Dylan, in New Hampshire, we saw a shift in power with Democrats taking over the Senate and the House, but Republican Chris Sununu remains governor. Do you see opportunities to work on issues that impact young people, like voting rights, college affordability, and climate crisis in such a divided government?
Yeah. So the Democrats also took the executive council, which is a fun little piece of government that we have here in New Hampshire that's not very common across the country. But we're already seeing Chris Sununu move more towards issues that young people care about since he took his re-oath back about a week ago. 2 days ago, he came out and requested a task force be made regarding offshore wind by the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which is something that young people made a real big priority in the Democratic primary for governors for 2 years in a row now. And we know that Chris Sununu also really likes his likability rating. He's flip-flopped on a lot of issues over his time as an executive counselor and governor. And he's always going back and forth on whether or not where he stands on an issue regarding the audience he's in front of. So we'll definitely get to see Chris Sununu move on issues like college affordability and climate change. But we also know that Chris Sununu is probably looking for higher office in the near future. He's pretty young, and his family is like a pretty popular historical political family in New Hampshire. So seeing him come around on some of those issues will probably play into his benefits moving forward. But voting rights is a really big thing here in New Hampshire, especially where we have the first in the nation primary, and young people really swing elections most of the time. Like we saw in the 2016 Senate race with Maggie Hassan, she only beat out Kelly Ayotte, an incumbent, by 1,000 votes. And at the University of New Hampshire, we had over 2,000 same-day registration students to vote on that election. So working with Governor Chris Sununu to stop the attack on voting rights with young people across the state is going to be really hard because we know that he's not going to budge on it.
Dylan, can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean specifically when you say the attack on voting rights that's really honed in on young people? I know you've got some legislation that might be enacted or that's just been enacted. Can you tell us kind of what that is, and should other state legislatures be concerned about something like this being enacted elsewhere? Like, what are the red flags? What's the problem here?
Yeah, so the problem is that our government is now making it a requirement for anybody who wants to vote in the state to be what they call a legal domicile liver here, which that means you have to now register your vehicle and switch over your driver's license to the state of New Hampshire to vote in elections, which costs hundreds of dollars. So the issue is for college students, students who live out of state but go to the universities here, they don't have to get New Hampshire's driver's license, and they don't have to register their vehicles here because most of them don't have vehicles. And most of them, like, live underneath their parents' home that helps them with their FAFSA and all that. And so requiring them to switch their residency to New Hampshire just to vote isn't a poll tax. And the ACLU has been calling it a poll tax since they've been talking about it for the past 3 years now. And they're only doing this because the student vote is so powerful in New Hampshire.
Absolutely. That makes, I mean, every time you see a voting rights bill or proposition like this, it always comes down to them suppressing someone's vote or a group of people's vote. And this clearly would impact young people so much because we are such a transient generation and one of the most broke generations to come because of all of our student debt. I also just wanted to ask you really quickly before we move on, you know, you talk about climate crisis as one of the, you know, and the climate change is one of the priorities as well. Any thoughts on what is happening right now in the 116th Congress when it comes to the Green New Deal and some of that and how that might play out in your work?
Yeah, so with the New Hampshire Youth Movement, we were actually really excited because we got both of New Hampshire's Congress people, Chris Pappas and Annie Custer, to come out in support of Ocasio-Cortez's Select Committee for the Green New Deal. And when we talk about the Green New Deal here in New Hampshire, a lot of the things we look forward to is job creation. Offshore wind turbines in the Gulf of Maine, which has been a lot of our work for the past 2 years, could create hundreds of jobs in the Portsmouth area or the seacoast area of New Hampshire. We have a lot of high school students that aren't moving on to four-year colleges but are moving on to two-year programs. And we think that connecting the jobs growth of the Green New Deal to New Hampshire, specifically regarding offshore wind, will be a real big advantage for a lot of people. Also, we have a lot of forestry workers in New Hampshire. Our biggest economy in New Hampshire is the forestry. So working with folks on how to maintain our forests properly and create biomass energy out of our national forests will be something that's really beneficial to a lot of communities that live northern, in the northern part of the state.
So I think we also wanted to make sure that we got to our third guest on this segment, Alex. Alex, yesterday you were in Austin with Move Texas to meet with elected officials about youth justice issues. Can you talk to us about what you discussed with them and the response you got from leaders there in Texas?
Sure. So Move Texas was in Austin yesterday, making the rounds at the Capitol on opening day of the legislative session, the 86th legislative session. And Move Texas took its legislative agenda with us, and we're working on quite a bit of legislation that we'll be authoring and working with our champions there at the state ledge to see passed, and also working with coalition partners to see those things passed. So those items that we're working on, especially because, you know, our wheelhouse is sort of making it easier for young people to vote in the state of Texas, a state that's so synonymous for voter suppression, voter difficulties, voter repression. So we want to introduce bills that make that easier. The bills that we want to introduce are voter registration standardization measures. So here in Texas, if you register as a deputy registrar, which makes you eligible to register voters, you kind of have to do that on a county-by-county basis, even though there's really kind of insignificant differences when it comes to the actual class you have to take. So it's an extra encumbrance on our deputy registrars to have to do that. So we want to introduce a bill that standardizes that across the state so that if you can register voters in, let's say, the county that San Antonio is in, Bexar County, but you also want to register voters in a place like Dallas or like Fort Worth, like a Tarrant County, that you'd be able to do so in both places. So we want to introduce some standardization measures. We also want to ensure that there's mandatory campus polling locations. We know that students are avid voters. We saw that in the last cycle. This is, you know, a midterm election where voter turnout increased 500% in the state of Texas, but there's not always a polling location on campus. And so we want to make sure that students get that ability to vote based on the fact that there's actually a facility where they can do so. So we want to make it mandatory for all college campuses with populations of 10,000 students or larger in the state of Texas would be mandated to have a campus polling location. So we're also authoring legislation around that. And then finally, we're authoring legislation around student ID as voter ID. So Texas is a state where your concealed handgun carry license is an eligible voting ID, but not your student ID.
Wow.
And we think that that, you know, is reflective of political values in the state that maybe leans sort of against the interest of young people, knowing mm-hmm. young people might have a voter ID, might not be a student ID, but might not be a gun owner. So we want to make sure that student ID is also valid as a voter ID across the state of Texas. So those are our three kind of big priorities in terms of voting rights. But then also sort of on economic justice, we're trying to defend a paid sick time ordinance that passed in San Antonio. So this is kind of a local control issue. We passed the paid sick time ordinance that brought paid sick time to 354,000 workers in the city of San Antonio. Mm-hmm. And there's an effort at the state to sort of try to preempt that, saying that it's in the state's jurisdiction and not in the local jurisdiction. And thankfully, when we went and met with our delegation in the cities that we work in, we find that there's a lot of reception. You know, there's a lot of excitement following the midterms, following the last cycle. So there's a lot of energy at the state ledge level.
That's awesome. And we have a couple more minutes left. And with that remaining time, I'd love to hear from each of you, you know, what is that one takeaway you want people to remember your organizing work and the priorities of your organization in your state? And also how can folks get involved and continue to pay attention, you know, whether that's through a website or your Twitter handle, whatever that might be. So, Charlie, I want to kick it off with you. In Colorado, you know, what is that top action or issue that people should really be paying attention to, and where should they go for that?
That's a great question. So in Colorado, you know, I have to say our work around student debt reform, you know, this is one of the big issues of our generation, a huge issue in Colorado. And we have, you know, massive opportunities this legislative session to actually move the needle on this issue and make the situation better for Coloradans. So we are constantly looking for folks to get involved, to contact their legislators, to come down to the Capitol with us, to educate their peers on it. So for folks who are interested in finding out more about that, they can check out our website, neweracolorado.org. We've got sign-up forms to volunteer, to find out more information, to join our leadership development program. So that's your one-stop shop for all the ways to get involved with that work this spring.
Wonderful. And where can folks find you as well?
And then for me, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Charlie_Olina. You can find us on Twitter for New Era Colorado as well, at New Era Colorado.
Great. And then Dylan, top priority? And then where can folks find you?
Yeah. I'd have to say the top priority is going to be voting rights. If we can't repeal House Bill 1264 and get young people their right back to vote in the 2020 election, then we're going to have, like, no opportunity to make an impact on the presidential election here in New Hampshire. And people can find me at the 10th Mountain on Twitter. That's my Twitter handle. And New Hampshire Youth Movement at nhyouthmovement.org.
Awesome. And then Alex? We can all follow Alex at Alex, A-L-E-X, Burnell, B-I-R-N-E-L on Twitter. I think, we're so grateful for our state organizers doing the hard work in the states. We have a lot going on here nationally, but it's always important and crucial to remember what's happening in the states as well. And we're really excited to see what you all do in the future. And we'll be back after the break soon. And Welcome back to the Millennial Takeover of the Leslie Marshall Show. My name is Anisha Singh.
And I'm Charlotte Hancock.
And we are now joined by Ellen Ratner for Talk Media News. Ellen, tell us what is going on today in the news.
Well, the most interesting thing, of course, is that President Trump wants to cut off the money to California. He said he wants to cut off money to fight California wildfires. He said the money is being wasted. He said billions of dollars are sent to the state of California for forest fires that with proper forest management would never happen. Well, you know, I'd like to know about what happened in the north part of Southern California, because there aren't any forests there, and yes, they still had a huge fire on the water. Mm-hmm. So what's that? They said unless they get their act together, which is unlikely, he said, I've ordered FEMA to send no more money. It is a disgraceful situation and in lives and money.
It's so interesting, right? Because it's California. I wonder why this is the state that he is picking to bully next on his list.
Well, I don't think there's much wonder. Yeah. Like California considers it terribly liberal.
Absolutely. What else is going on today?
Okay. Well, we also have a situation where the president is very concerned about his tax reform law. Democrats in the coming year are going to be actually laying the groundwork to eventually roll back parts of President Trump's tax law. Now, they can't do that while the Senate is controlled by the Republicans, but they're planning on 2020 when they'll either take over the White House or the Senate or maybe both. And so they're trying to lay the groundwork for that in terms of that. Now, no Democratic lawmakers voted for what he signed in terms of the tax rebates. As you know, they're providing benefits to wealthy individuals, corporations, and they're also adding to the federal deficit, which went up 17% last year.
Jeez.
What?
If you can imagine.
That is crazy. And then I hear that there is some news going on with Russia, as per usual.
Well, that's right. So basically, the woman that participated in the talks that were happening at Trump Tower was actually indicted yesterday, but on a different money laundering scheme than that. And also, it looks like Paul Manafort, former business partner, who is a former Russian military officer, tried to get him to basically gave him information on polling, which, of course, he turned over to Putin. Mm-hmm. Hello? And then, of course, they interfered with the American elections, which we know, and I expect Mueller's report, even though some of the Trump people are trying to get it deep six so that the public doesn't see it, I think they will see it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Ellen, for today's news. And this was the first show of the new year for the Millennial Takeover. My name, again, is Anisha Singh.
And I'm Charlotte Hancock.
We look forward to speaking to y'all next week.